nation. He'll get over that and we'll be fine. I'm a big girl. I can take it. Everyone in the Fox building did one of two things when they saw me. Congratulated me, or asked if I was doing okay. Such an odd combination of celebration and sympathy. I would get very used to it in the months to come. Most nights, the Kelly File is live at 9 p.m., but that day we pre-taped it with the studio audience reacting to the debate. When I was done, it was almost 9. I sat at my desk in my office and flipped around the channels to see what the coverage looked like. Every channel was wall-to-wall debate coverage, with most talking about my question and Trump's attacks on me. On CNN, Don Lemon was anchoring, and Trump was doing a phoner. I heard later that Trump had insisted his interview with Lemon air opposite our show at 9 p.m., as opposed to at 10 p.m. when Don usually anchors. CNN acquiesced and gave Trump a 30-minute phoner commercial-free. For what it's worth, the Kelly File crushed them in the ratings that night. Lemon asked Trump, "What is it with you and Megyn Kelly?" Trump answered, "Well, I just don't respect her as a journalist. I have no respect for her. I don't think she's very good. She's highly overrated. But when I come out there, what am I doing? I'm not getting paid for this. I go out there, they start saying, 'Lift up your arm if you're...' I didn't know there were going to be 24 million people. I knew there was going to be a big crowd because I get big crowds. They call me the ratings machine. So she gets out and she starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. And you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever. In my opinion, she was off base. And by the way, not in my opinion, in the opinion of hundreds of thousands of people on Twitter. She's a lightweight, and I couldn't care less about her." My wherever? I emailed Irina Briganti, Fox's top PR person. "Did you see that?" I asked. She had indeed. Fox News is very good at responding when one of its people is attacked. But we were in uncharted territory. We had to be careful. This was a frontrunner in the campaign. I certainly did not want to get down into the mud with him, but I was also stunned at the tone of his attacks. And yet I don't think I realized the magnitude of what had just happened, or where those comments would take us. I texted Don Lemon, with whom I'm friendly. "Cannot believe the latest," I wrote. "Continue taking the high road," he responded. I like Lemon. I enjoy his approach to the news. Some people would later give him a hard time for not calling out Trump on the blood comments in the moment. I don't think Lemon understood the comments to be a reference to a woman's menstrual cycle. There's still debate about whether that's what Trump meant. Trump would later say he meant my nose or ears, but I was fine with how Lemon handled it. I was heading to the Jersey Shore that night to be with Doug and my kids for the weekend. It was Friday. Getting into that car was like getting into a warm bath. I was done with the debate and the months of preparation that went into it. Brett, Chris, Salmon, Steyerwalt, and I all felt great about it and were exchanging emails about the strong reviews. Frank Bruni's in the New York Times was particularly memorable. "The debate was riveting," Bruni wrote. "It was admirable. It compels me to write a cluster of words I never imagined writing. Hooray for Fox News." Once again, the insult tied to the compliment. I was finally on my way to my family, my happiness, the heart of what I truly am. It was in the back of that car that everything seemed to explode. Staring at my phone, I saw the internet lose its mind over those blood comments, and I knew as that car sped through the dark night, phone glowing in my hand, that things would never be the same again. Chapter 21. Fallout. The shocks came one after the other. Within hours of the Lemon interview, Eric Erickson disinvited Trump from a conservative gathering he was about to host. Eric Erickson, the very man I had publicly castigated for his sexist views on women, was castigating a different man for his comments about me. I couldn't believe it. I could not keep up with all the emails, texts, and notifications coming in, many with the hashtag #IStandWithMegyn. I felt uncomfortable. The story was growing, and I wanted it extinguished. The exchange was catching fire in a way I had never seen before. My head was swimming. It is truly bizarre to cover the news for a living and then to see yourself actually become the news from coast to coast and beyond. I felt like Alice through the looking glass. I was used to talking about politicians. All of a sudden, politicians were talking about me. On Twitter, Carly Fiorina wrote, "Mr. Trump, there is no excuse," adding, "I stand with @MeganKelly. Scott Walker wrote, "There's no excuse for Trump's comments. @MeganKelly is a tough interview. Being POTUS is tougher." John Kasich, Rick Perry, George Pataki, Jeb Bush, Lindsey Graham, to name just a few, weighed in with similar condemnations, and some called for Trump to drop out of the race. It was clear now that this story wasn't going away anytime soon. At first, I felt gratified that to the extent people felt the need to comment on it at all, they appeared to be saying enough is enough, that Trump should stop the nonsense. But in 24 hours, I would feel very differently. This was the beginning of a cycle I would go through many, many times with Trump. A master at manipulating the media, he would find a way to reset the public's perception of an event within days or even hours. The media was, of course, eager to give him the platform. Someone asked me later if I felt embarrassed that the nation was discussing my menstrual cycle. I didn't. It was more like disbelief. What was happening? Every show in the nation is leading with Trump talking about my period? I mean, who the hell has a file for that one? Trump denied that the comments meant what many thought they meant. He said in a statement that only a sick person or a deviant would think that he was referring to menstruation, a line that would wind up the subject of considerable mockery, especially by Jimmy Fallon. He would do the same thing later after mocking Carly Fiorina's appearance. "Look at that face," he said on the trail. "Would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that, the face of our next president? I mean, she's a woman, and I'm not supposed to say bad things, but really, folks, come on, are we serious?" Trump would later dismiss this as an innocent comment about her persona. Fiorina later addressed that at a debate, saying, "I think women all over the country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said. It was a mic drop moment for her." I found it curious that no one was asking Trump about his retweets of people calling me a bimbo, which were unambiguous and continuing around this same time. Blood apparently trumps bimbo on the scale of offensive rhetoric. Indeed, bimbo didn't seem to carry much shock value. Trump also continued saying that I was terrible, unfair, a lightweight, and so on. People were calling it a feud or a war, when in fact it was a one-sided offensive. I had neither baited him nor fought back. I just sat and watched and waited for it to end. Looking at the constant ongoing barrage from him and the vitriol coming from so many of his supporters, I realized for the first time, he's not stopping. I had seen angry politicians before, but usually they wore themselves out once they got a complaint out of their system. Trump seemed to be gaining steam. Later, I would return to work to find a litany of voicemails. Someone had released my number on the internet, calling me a C-word, a B-word, and an effing whore. This wasn't particularly enjoyable to listen to, but it didn't really upset me. Again, unfortunately, it can be part of the job, as virtually anyone who upset Trump during his presidential run found out. One caller reamed me for raising the women issue at all, saying, "No one gives a damn about misogyny. This country has real problems." One of the greatest ironies was that with every new comment, Trump was proving the point of my question. I had asked about how he would combat the likely Hillary narrative that he is part of the so-called war on women, a meme used rather effectively by the Democrats in 2012. With each new blow against me, I thought, she's gonna hit you with that one, too. Late that Friday night, I arrived at the shore and slipped into bed with Doug. The next morning, I told Doug about what had happened. He was angry about the blood comment and wanted to know what Fox was doing about it. I told him the truth. Nothing for now. What could they do? Roger was talking to Trump daily, trying to calm him down. But it wasn't working. Many in the press questioned why Fox wasn't hitting back hard at Trump, given Roger's infamous love of fighting and the nature of the attacks on me. I understood Roger's decision, however. None of us wanted a fight with Trump. What we wanted was to cover his fight with his opponents. It was that morning that I saw Trump's attorney and executive vice president of the Trump Organization, Michael Cohen, getting retweeted over and over and over again with a message directed at me. He had retweeted a Trump supporter who said, hashtag boycott Megyn Kelly, @RealDonaldTrump, we can gut her. gut her. For the first time, I felt alarmed. Michael Cohen is the same man who had threatened Daily Beast reporter Tim Mack with the line, "What I'm going to do to you is going to be effing disgusting." At the time, he was Trump's main surrogate, his top message man, and is to this day a loyal soldier in the Trump army. Now, as tempers were already at a fever pitch, he was telling his 40,000 followers to gut me? This went too far, and was easily the thing from Team Trump that most bothered me in the days after the debate. As if on cue, the threats skyrocketed. Fox has to do something, Doug demanded. Trump may have been polling well with white men across America, but not so much with those inside my apartment. I later found out that Fox was doing something. Bill Shine called Cohen directly and tried to make him understand this kind of irresponsible messaging had already led to death threats. Cohen, a frequent guest on Fox News, was not particularly moved. Shine, exasperated by Cohen's indifference, tried to explain it in terms Cohen might understand. If Megyn Kelly is killed, it's not going to help your candidate. Sean Hannity also worked behind the scenes to lower the temperature among Trump's more prominent supporters, including some on talk radio and online, who were ratcheting up the anger. He didn't have to do it, but he had my back. I was growing concerned. With the threats, the misinformation, the battering ram being used on my reputation and my relationship with my viewers, I realized that my pre-taped segment with Howie Kurtz was going to air Sunday morning, and it occurred to me that I should contact him. I wanted to be sure that given the "gut her" tweet and the amount of threats pouring in, he made it clear that my "no big deal" reaction was taped prior to the weekend's events. Having lived under threat years before with the stalker, I didn't want to give the impression that threats to my safety were fair game. Howie understood completely and agreed to make that point. I went back to work that Monday and Tuesday, as previously planned. I would then start a 10-day vacation at the shore. When I got back to New York for my Monday night show, things were strained around the building. So many of my colleagues were incredibly supportive, but there were also plenty who had no idea what to say to me. Was I a heroine or a victim or a villain? Should they high-five me or hug me or hate me? I think it was unclear to many of them. A few were vocal Trump supporters who, like Trump himself, appeared to be somewhat angry with me. I toughed it out for 2 days, heartened that a break was coming my way. On the Kelly file, I announced that I was going on vacation. "It's been an interesting week," I said. "A long 6 months without a vacation for yours truly. So I'll be taking the next week and a half off, spending some time with my husband and my kids, trying to relax. Have a great week." The statement fell on deaf ears. By the time I arrived at the shore in the wee hours of the morning, Trump supporters were already celebrating the fiction that I had been suspended. Trump fueled the rumor with more tweets, saying I should take another 11-day unscheduled vacation and that my show was better without me. His Twitter brigade rejoiced. Of course, it wasn't true. You don't get suspended for moderating a debate watched by nearly 25 million people and asking all the candidates hard questions. Even from the shore, I spoke to Roger often. We wrestled with what to do, since the company could not control Trump, but didn't want to aggravate him or his supporters further. To its credit, Fox came out and publicly ridiculed the suspension nonsense, as up there with alleged UFO sightings. Later, they would also issue a strong statement defending me and my debate questioning. My time at the beach was otherworldly. I tried to ignore the insanity, but everyone I knew during my vacation asked me about it whenever I saw them. I started to feel like someone with a bad medical result. The way people would react to me, "Are you okay? How are you? You hanging in there?" Going online was an exercise in self-flagellation. Angry, threatening messages were everywhere. This was well beyond the typical "you suck" that any tough questioning of a candidate might get you in 2016 cable news. It was "effing die, bitch," and "if I see you, you better run," and "I wouldn't be sleeping too soundly if I were you. Watch out." There wasn't one in particular that stood out. It was more the uncontainable level of rage that was surprising and disconcerting. Fox informed me that they, too, continued to receive threats to my life. I would spend many days in the coming months accompanied by security. A word on these threats. Despite their number, it bears noting that I wasn't walking around constantly in fear. I didn't actively worry that I might get attacked. It was more of a recognition that the risk was heightened, that I needed to be careful, to take precautions, and be aware, especially when with my children. Most disturbing were the overwhelming number and violent nature of the messages we were receiving, and the way Trump's anger was evidently seen by some as a call to action. Trump told his supporters that Mexican immigrants were bringing drugs and were rapists, and shortly thereafter, Hispanics were attacked by Trump fans. Trump later rationalized, "My supporters are very passionate." Trump told his crowds they should punch protesters in the face. Sure enough, they did. Trump called the media disgusting and openly shamed them to his fans. The media then got physically attacked at Trump rallies. The point is, some of Trump's supporters took his word as gospel, and Trump's word, and that of his lawyer, on me was clear. Megyn Kelly is no good. Gut her. At times I wondered if I had done something other than ask a tough debate question. Had I attacked Trump while in some rogue dream state? What else could possibly explain this level of anger? Doug insisted that I step away from the iPhone. "You have to leave your phone at home when we go out," he said. "Look at it once in the morning, once in the afternoon, once at night. That's it." Then he put it in a drawer. It helped. Every time I turned my phone back on, it practically exploded with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of messages. One nice memory of that time was that for every nasty incoming note, I received many supportive emails from friends at Fox and elsewhere. "We love you," they would write, or, "This is wrong. We stand behind you." Janice Dean and Dana Perino, my two closest friends at Fox, were particular standouts. Steyerwalt, too, was such a good friend to me. My old pal Kelly texted me, "Bat shit crazy," which summed it up perfectly. My sister-in-law Diane wished me, via text, the courage to continue being big and brave and beautiful. Katie Couric, whom I've always liked, reached out to me, too. She'd been through her own public backlash after she had the nerve to ask Sarah Palin in the run-up to the 2008 election what newspaper she read. "Are you okay?" she wrote me. "Do you need some Tampax?" Doug and I appreciated the chance to laugh. Even Harvard's David Cutler, a mild-mannered guy who helped craft Obamacare and whom I used to argue with on the air, emailed me and said, "I hope you're okay. Let me know if there's anything I can do." That email stood out as especially sweet. Janice, her husband Sean, and their two boys came to visit us at the shore. They helped take our mind off the threats as much as possible. But things were tense. Our neighbors reported seeing strange cars casing our home. Another neighbor spotted a photographer in our backyard, then one on our front porch. We kept the blinds closed most of the time, wondering where this would go. Would people be trying to catch me in a compromising position, similar to what happened with Aaron Andrews and that peeping Tom? Word spread of still more unfamiliar characters on or near our property, and the police stepped up their patrols. I talked to my mom about it, and she was angry at Trump and incredulous at his willingness to play the victim. The main thing she wanted to know was whether Roger was behind me. I told her the truth, which was that he had many considerations to factor in. The last day of vacation, Doug played in a doubles tennis match. He and his friend Matt play in this tournament every year. It's held at the summer club Doug grew up a part of, where he learned to sail and play tennis years ago. Matt and Doug are both very well-liked guys, tall, fit, friendly, and handsome. They had made it to the finals of the tournament, where they faced off against two men who were a bit older, shorter, and, as it turned out, better tennis players that year. The opponents wound up beating Matt and Doug in the third set. One of the men had complained about the rules for much of the match, to the point where the crowd began openly booing him. His partner said very little. It was crowded on the club balcony above the court. I was there along with Janice and Sean, the wives of the other players, and other family members, cheering our guys on. Our children were with me. When the match ended, I made my way over to the gate leading off the court so I could see Doug. The complaining player was over at the umpire's chair, showing him a rule book. His silent partner made a beeline off the court, not toward his wife or kids, but toward me. When he got to me, he was silent no more. He pointed his finger at my face, looked me in the eye, and boomed, "Trump, 2016. This was his first reaction to his own victory. He wasn't celebrating or hugging his family. He was pointing at me and angrily yelling, "Trump." Doug had not seen the incident, and when he saw my stunned face, he asked me what was wrong. I told him what had just happened. Immediately, he turned around, grabbed the man by the shoulder, and threatened to hurt him if he said another word to me. Then he stormed off the court. The player would later complain that Doug had broken the club's etiquette rules by threatening him. He was particularly upset that Doug had done this in front of the man's wife, which struck me as ironic. It was jarring to see Trump's anger manifest so personally in my own life. I wondered if this was my new reality. Angry Trump supporters yelling at me. And indeed, it would happen many times over the next year. On the bright side, I told Doug, "You are definitely getting action tonight. Why should there be no silver linings?" Doug's mother, Jackie, had been at the beach with us. She had to return home to Philadelphia, and on her way home, she pulled over to the side of the road. She and I hadn't gotten the chance to really talk, and she wanted to see how I was doing. She didn't want to half-ass it, talking while driving or not giving the discussion her full attention. She sat in a parking lot and did something she rarely does, gave advice. She told me the country could see who I really was, that this man was not convincing any reasonable person of anything about me, that I had handled myself with dignity, that I was loved. I held on to that talk for a long time. I returned to work 10 days later, on August 24th. I met with Roger, Irina, and a friend of Roger, attorney and counselor Peter Johnson Jr., in Roger's office that day. Peter had been a vocal Trump defender on the air for some time, and I wondered what he was doing there. We had agreed over the previous weekend that I should offer an on-camera statement upon my return, and we were there to discuss a draft. The overall goal was for me to stay above it all, not to get drawn into a fight. We discussed Trump's blood comments, the bimbo tweet, the gut her tweet, and the attempts to get Trump to listen to reason during my vacation. Roger felt reasonably certain that he had calmed Trump down for now, even though Trump had not let up during my break, tweeting out my old GQ photos and calling me a bimbo. "He'll do it again," I said to him. "We fight tomorrow's fight tomorrow," Roger responded. This was the first time we had all sat down together since the debate, and I shared with the group the story about what had happened the morning of the debate, my sudden illness, my doctor, and so on. Peter Johnson Jr. heard mention of vomiting and asked whether there might be a different, happier reason I had fallen ill, suggesting I may have been expecting. I looked at him and deadpanned, "Haven't you heard? I'm on my period." That first night back on the air, tensions were running high. I felt a little nervous, and I don't really get nervous about doing TV anymore. It seemed like the eyes of the world were on me. The air in the studio felt heavy. I could feel the energy of people tuning in, waiting. Moments earlier, Trump had been on O'Reilly for 2 blocks, an interesting choice by Bill for my first day back. They had not discussed Trump's bogus suspension claims or any of his comments about me. I went out and sat down at my desk in the studio. This is normally where I feel most powerful. That desk has a way of transforming me into a stronger version of myself. When in that spot, I feel in command. That night, however, I just felt anxious to get it over with. Now, I love my staff and my crew, my audio guy and stage director and my cameramen. I think of them as my Scarecrow and Lion and Tin Man times a few. Every night I'm with these guys. These are my guys. We talk about the guests, the news, our spouses, our lives, Fox, everything. They're like brothers to me. They all greeted me warmly and asked how I was. "Hanging in there," I said. I sat down. It was 8:57 p.m. My statement was loaded in the teleprompter, and I practiced it one time, which I almost never do. I wanted to make sure I could get it out clean. I could see the red numbers counting down on the bottom of my camera. It was 8:59:53. We were about to bong in with the open. My shoulders were inched up a little higher than normal. Tension. My stage manager, James, locked eyes with me and nodded his head. He started counting me down. 7, 6, 5. It was at that moment that Dion, our audio guy, yelled from offstage, "We love you!" I still can't think about that moment without tearing up. It had not been an easy time. Off the set, we don't really know each other all that well. I mean, I throw a party for the gang at Christmas and we have fun. They know I would do anything for them. But I could feel the support in that room. When I read that statement, "Mr. Trump has attacked me personally. I have chosen not to respond," I was thinking about my crew. I don't need to prove anything to anyone. Those who know me know who I am. I believed, hoped, that would be the end of it with Trump, who I promised to cover without fear or favor. We now know it was nowhere near the end. There is no modern historical precedent for a mainstream political candidate targeting a journalist as Trump targeted me, nor was there any example to follow. If I had one guiding principle, it was to take the high road. Britt Hume understood and would observe to me months later, "The policy of dignity has served you very well." I consider myself lucky, because I have a big platform. I get to show the world who I am every night. Truth drowns out the unmoored lie. I really believed that. I used my platform at times to defend other women Trump went after, including Katie Turr of MSNBC, CNN's Sarah Murray, and Heidi Cruz, who was the subject of a nasty Trump retweet comparing her looks unfavorably to those of Trump's wife, Melania. But I never responded to Trump's personal attacks on me. I think that frustrated Trump. He began to mock the fact that Fox News would occasionally respond to him, but I would not. It was clear that Trump was baiting me, that he wanted me to engage with him, which only shored up my resolve not to do so. I'm guessing I seemed to Trump like the women he could usually charm. When I was not charmed, perhaps he felt confused. I think he didn't know quite what to do with me. With a bit more hindsight, I think Trump was bothered by me, not necessarily because I'm a woman, but because I'm a woman with power. I had the 9 p.m. show on Fox News, his favorite channel, and I couldn't be brought to heel. I think he believed I could help or hurt him more than Anderson Cooper or Chuck Todd, both of whom also covered Trump with skepticism, or just about anyone else in the media. That's why he repeatedly demanded a boycott and wanted me pulled from future debates, and his supporters petitioned to have me fired. They wanted to remove me from power. People often ask me, given the number of Trump's tweets and barbs, how did you keep from responding to him? One thing I remembered came from my mom. She always said that parents can project one of three things to their children: the good me, the bad me, or the not me. If a child can't get attention for being good, he'll try being bad. Any attention is better than none. The worst thing for a child is the not me, to feel that he's not worthy of a response, no matter his behavior. That's how you deal with a bully. A bully wants your attention. Give it to him and you're feeding the fire. You stay focused on your game. As I always tell my team in times of controversy, head down, shoulders back, forge forward. Chapter 22. Relentless. During the 9 months following the August debate, Trump's poll numbers rose steadily. It didn't matter what he said or did. Republican primary voters were angry, and they liked that he was angry too. Trump remained angry with me, which made it tough to extract myself from this strange space. I was still covering the news, but I was also being covered. Although I did nothing to stoke or even respond to it, the Trump versus me storyline was still regularly in the press. At times, I felt as if I had been dropped into a shark tank, watched by slightly horrified passers-by, as I tried to get out and get back on solid ground. Every appearance I made on other shows or in public venues, the interviewers asked me about Trump, and not much other than Trump. I did my best to politely move on. As his campaign continued to dominate, more reporters ultimately started challenging Trump on his call to ban all Muslims, his reversals on substantive issues, and his attack on New York Times reporter Serge Kovaleski's physical disability, to name a few. If Trump believed anything he said or did might be problematic for him, he would simply deny he said or did it. And throughout the primaries, the media usually gave him a pass, often because almost instantaneously, and some believed intentionally, he was on to the next controversy. He attacked many journalists who pressed him on his vulnerabilities, but he never went after the other reporters in the same way he did with me. Meanwhile, his focus on me was incessant. "I refuse to call Megyn Kelly a bimbo, because that would not be politically correct," he tweeted. "Instead, I will only call her a lightweight reporter." And then, "If crazy at Megyn Kelly didn't cover me so much on her terrible show, her ratings would totally tank. She is so average in so many ways." Just as I would think the onslaught was over, he would again go on the attack. Then he would quiet down, and then start back up again. In just a few months' time, Trump offered scores of insults about me, on television and on Twitter. The word was relentless. Every time he started in, I would get a call from Roger, who was getting calls from Trump. Was I being fair to Trump? Was I being too hard on him? He felt the bar for skeptical Trump coverage should be higher. Tom and I disagreed. The pressure was intense, internally and externally. There was often no discernible trigger for Trump's attacks. Something that seemed of no consequence would set him off without warning. For example, after Vanity Fair profiled me that winter, Trump popped up to complain about it. There was a line in the story that mentioned he had tried to woo me before he announced his presidential bid, with notes and calls, and by sending me articles written about me that he had signed. In response, Trump denied it, saying, "The last person in the world I would try to woo is Megyn Kelly," and claiming that he had never sent me anything other than polls. I didn't say anything more at the time because it didn't seem worth ginning it up again. For the record, some of the many notes he denied sending can be found in the photo section of the print version of this book, which you should go out and buy. Over the 2015 holidays, tragedy struck our family. My stepbrother Patrick died. Patrick, Peter's son, was a gentle and loving man. He managed a Rite Aid. He supported his children. And 1 week before Christmas, he had a sudden, massive heart attack at age 47, just a few months before he was supposed to walk his daughter down the aisle. Patrick led a quiet life. He loved his kids, his dogs, and going on day trips with his wife. His Facebook page was filled with sweet animal videos and pictures of his kids. He never had anything but a kind word for people. Peter was distraught. Liza had to take a leave of absence from her nursing job, and a dark pall was cast over our family. We spent the days leading up to the holiday burying Patrick and saying goodbye. As we dealt with the loss, and I saw my family, especially Peter, in such pain, I was reminded of how little all the political nonsense meant, of how much value there is in simply being a good man, even if not a powerful one. It was around this time that I first considered reaching out to Trump. I'd been thinking about the pointlessness of being mired in conflict, of what a waste all that emotional energy was. My mom had taught me this from an early age, that conflict resolution is a gift to yourself. I learned it again when I decided to leave the law, in part because of the constant acrimony. This was not how I wanted to lead my life. Some controversy is unavoidable, but constant brawling is not good. It's just not how you want to spend your time. I asked some colleagues at work who were close to Trump if they thought I should reach out to him. To a person, they told me Trump was too angry, that his hatred for me was too deep-seated. I decided to give him some more time. I returned to New York to more vitriol, messages calling me misogynistic names, or people returning their signed headshots of me, writing the word traitor across the picture. I wondered what kind of person spends the Christmas holiday sending hate mail. I received a nice message from, of all people, Dr. Phil, and it lifted my spirits. He reminded me that bullies who poke you with a stick want to see you jump. Not long after that, he came to Fox for a promotional appearance on The Kelly File, and an incredible thing happened. We became friends. It won't surprise you to learn how much that meant to me. He told me about an interview he had given shortly after one of Trump's tirades against me. He told the reporter, "Successful lawyer, top journalist, wife, mother of three children. If that's a bimbo, I hope all of my granddaughters grow up to be bimbos." I loved that, and I am still floored by the fact that the man who changed my life from the Oprah set is now someone I can call for advice. We spent most of January preparing for the next Fox News debate in Iowa. Trump was firing off nasty tweets about me here and there, but nothing too incendiary, until the Saturday before the debate, when out of the blue, he threatened not to come. He went on Twitter and asked his followers if he should go to the debate at all. He accused me of being unfair. For the first time, I thought, is this real or is this for attention? With Trump, you just never know. Sunday, he kept at it. Tweet, tweet, tweet. At the same time, Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, made a phone call to Bill Salmon and tried to get me booted off of the debate team. When Salmon told him that was out of the question, Lewandowski threatened me, saying I had had a rough couple of days after that last debate, and he would hate to have me go through that again. The tone was unmistakable. Salmon warned Lewandowski that he was out of line. I was far from the only woman or reporter Lewandowski had threatened during Trump's campaign. Trump fired him many months later. Then CNN hired him for a reported $500,000 a year. That Monday, January 25th, Trump went on CNN to say he might not show because of me. I don't like her. She doesn't treat me fairly. I'm not a big fan of hers at all. I was at a loss. Why would he allow me to have so much of a role in his campaign? He told CNN he might be the best thing that had ever happened to me, saying no one had ever heard of me before my dust-up with him. Obviously not true, but typical Trump. There were some editorials about the sexism of this claim, but that was not my reaction. My main thought was how ironic it was for him to suggest he had made my career, while he was in fact trying to destroy it, and how ironic of him to suggest that I was the one who needed a man's help to succeed, given our relative backgrounds and fathers. On Tuesday, Trump kept at it. He put up an Instagram poll asking his followers if he should participate in the debate, given my involvement. He was upping the ante. Later, Trump posted a video of himself with the caption, "Should I do the hashtag GOP debate?" In the video, he says into the camera, "Megyn Kelly is really biased against me. She knows that, I know that, everybody knows that. Do you really think she can be fair at a debate?" I was in disbelief. Doug joked, "Should we vote?" Trump's taking to Instagram was the last straw for Roger. He fired off a statement dripping with sarcasm. It read, in part, "We learned from a secret back channel that the Ayatollah and Putin both intend to treat Donald Trump unfairly when they meet with him if he becomes president." Within a few hours, Trump bailed from the debate, citing Roger's statement as his sole reason. It was, once again, the lead on every national news network, and once again, many in the media seemed to be taking at face value Trump's explanation, too lazy to look back at the preceding days and Trump's crescendo of complaints about me. Roger canceled a couple of interviews Trump had scheduled on Fox, including, I was told, one set for 24 hours prior to the debate on the O'Reilly factor. But O'Reilly refused to cancel Trump. Sure enough, Trump appeared and went on the attack, over and over again. There was no context offered for how we had gotten here. That Trump had spent the previous 6 months attacking Fox and me, including another bimbo tweet just that morning. Instead, O'Reilly apologized to Trump, extolled the virtues of forgiveness, and asked Trump to consider turning the other cheek. From what? I wondered. O'Reilly ended the interview by joking about all the milkshakes he and Trump had shared together. I was sitting in my makeup chair in Iowa, getting ready for my show when I saw it. To me, it was the culmination of so much that had taken place since Trump began his tirade 6 months earlier. The unchallenged attacks, the misinformation, the tension in my own work environment. For the first time since August, I felt a surge of anger, and then, finally, a surge of tears. I put my hand over my eyes. "It's too much," Vincenza said softly, and that was how it felt to me. Like too much. While I wasn't happy with that interview, the truth is, Bill has done far more good than bad for me over the course of my career, and he too was in an awkward spot that night. I believe he was genuinely trying to get Trump to reconsider his decision to skip the Fox News debate and did not want to antagonize him. In time, I let go of it and moved on. Debate day arrived, and I awoke to see that Trump had retweeted a fake picture of me with two Saudis wearing full Muslim garb. Abby tried to keep it from me, concerned it was some sort of dog whistle to those who might be anti-Muslim, and that it might lead to even more aggressive post-Trump threats than usual. I had security with me and tried to put it out of my mind. The Trumpless debate went great. Many commentators remarked afterward on how refreshing it was to watch the candidates define themselves on their own terms, rather than in relation to Trump. Some also noted my new, much shorter haircut. I loved cutting my hair off. It felt empowering, like saying, "Here I am, have at it." I had actually cut my hair a couple of months earlier, just before Halloween, but this was a big night, so more people noticed. It took some of the wind out of our Halloween costumes. Doug and I, happy to make fun of a ridiculous situation, went as Donald Trump and Megyn Kelly. When Doug went into the costume store to buy a Make America Great Again hat and a wig, the checkout girl actually asked him, "Does your wife need a Megyn Kelly outfit?" We headed out on Halloween, and a stranger, seeing the new hair, dropped a line on Doug straight out of the movie Dave, in which a presidential lookalike tries to pass himself off as the actual president, going out in public with the actual first lady. "You're good. She needs some work." So that was that. The second Fox News debate was over. I was relieved. We stayed to cover the Iowa caucuses, which Trump lost. He later blamed his loss in part on his decision to skip the debate, his final job interview. We covered the results and then went home. Even though Trump lost Iowa, his poll numbers continued to rise. I couldn't say whether the attacks on me, or others for that matter, were directly helping him, but they definitely generated media coverage and kept Trump in the news, which is just where he loved to be. I marveled at how women were flocking to Trump, notwithstanding the nature of his attacks, which by this point had expanded to Carly Fiorina. Over time, his numbers with women would crater. But I also understood their anger at the politicians in Washington that had so let them down. In Trump, they had found someone they believed was a fighter, someone who would go to bat for them, whether others liked it or not. He said our elected leaders were losers, that we never win anymore, that with him, we would win so much we'd get tired of winning. He sold his candidacy as something bigger than regime change. He pitched it as the chance to feel good about ourselves again, to feel strong. After Trump lost Iowa, he went on to win New Hampshire and South Carolina. "This is happening," pundits started to realize. My mom called me up and said, "He's right about one thing. I'm getting tired of the winning." No sooner did I arrive back in New York than we had to start preparing for our next debate, which was just 30 days away on March 3rd in Detroit. Again? Debate prep is the most intense work we do. The researching, fact-checking, and question-writing process is meticulous and thorough. That alone requires dozens of hours, but the added layer of, "What's Trump gonna do next?" was an extra stressor and an unwelcome distraction. Through all of this, I was doing my nightly show, which was full of Trump news. I was determined to live up to the promise I had made months earlier, on my first day back from vacation, to cover Trump fairly and without fear. I asked my team to help. If they saw the show tilting too far in any direction, too hard on Trump out of a desire to punish him, or too soft out of a desire to appease him, they had an invitation and an obligation to speak up. Night after night, we did our best. These are seasoned professionals. They care deeply about the viewers and the product we put on air each night. Trump and some of his supporters felt we were too hard on him. I would argue we merely stood out by comparison. Doug and I were raising our children. I was writing this book. I was starting to work on a special for Fox Broadcasting, a Barbara Walters-type in-depth interview show. There was a lot going on. I wasn't seeing enough of my family. When I go too long without spending ample time with my children, my heart aches. I'm not happy. Abby usually guards my schedule to protect my family time, but Abby suddenly had a family issue of her own. Her first baby arrived 2 months early. She and little Aubrey were fine, thank God. But just like that, Abby was gone, much earlier than expected. My friend, my confidant, I missed her terribly. Her fill-in, Emily Jeffers, fresh out of college, got a jaw-dropping introduction to life in cable news. It started to feel like my law days again. Acrimony, long hours, too little fun. That's okay for a while. Work doesn't need to be fun at all times. Work pays the bills, and in the case of TV news, it's also a public service. But if something that was good morphs into something that is not good, and is not changing back, one has to stay conscious of that too. Settling for more is not an end game, it's an active process. It means staying aware of one's surroundings, because more is a fluid concept. Life changes, and requires that we change too. Before I knew it, it was time for the third Fox debate in Detroit. Trump would be at this one. I spent debate day in a makeshift office at the fabulous Fox Theater, reading up on Trump University, which I knew would come up that night. Just before I headed down to the stage, Yates and Yardley, fresh off a plane, burst into my office with Doug. What a perspective setter. Just in case you were thinking this debate mattered to your life at all, Mom, we're here to remind you that it doesn't. Being in their presence is grounding. They're like an elixir in times of stress. Yardley said she was a little nervous. Why? I asked her. I'm afraid of Donald Trump, she said softly. He wants to hurt me. No, he does not, I emphatically corrected. Doug and I exchanged a shocked look. Well, she said, he wants to hurt you, so he wants to hurt me too. No, honey, never, I told her. Doug and I had never discussed, and never would discuss, threats in front of our children. Donald Trump does not want to hurt Mommy, I told her. We just had a little disagreement. We're friends now, I lied. And he's a good daddy. He would never, ever hurt you. Doug and I looked at each other, eyebrows raised. Yards seemed to feel better. As surprising as this exchange with my child was, there were plenty of other contenders for most memorable moment of the Trump absurdity, like this one. Mommy, what's a bimbo? Yardley asked one day upon returning from school. What? What's a bimbo? I could not believe my ears. We certainly had never told Yardley, nor any of our children, that Trump had used that word about me. But she lives in this world, and sometimes well-meaning people, or kids, can say things not knowing the effect they will have. It's a not nice word for a woman, I said. What a moment. The same girl who the previous summer, surrounded by the most accomplished, powerful women in America, believed she was one of them, was now afraid of the man who might be president and asking me what the word bimbo meant. To this day, I think about that juxtaposition and the loss she suffered, which she doesn't yet realize. Brett, Chris, and I took to the stage. Trump was directly in front of me. I didn't speak much until about 30 minutes into it. Then it was my turn. We were both polite. You're looking well, he said. As are you, I responded. The Q&A went fine. Brett and I shot each other a look that said, that went well. Off we go. That debate was raucous. Rubio's campaign was flailing, and so was he. He tried getting crass with Trump, and it did not go well for anyone. Trump infamously used his time on stage to tout the alleged size of his manhood. Brett, Chris, and I kept our cool. When the cameras weren't on us, Brett and I again looked at each other. Did he really just say that? I hit Trump with a videotape question, getting right to the heart of some of his many position reversals. Wallace pressed Trump on his economic arguments and hit him with a fact check that would make big headlines the next day. Still no signs of anger. So far, so good. As predicted, Trump University did come up. This was a school Trump had started for aspiring real estate moguls that resulted in a class action for fraud. A court compared the plaintiffs to the victims of Bernie Madoff. The school was ultimately closed. At the time, it had a D-minus rating from the Better Business Bureau. As he had done before, Trump denied this fact at the debate. I challenged him, which led to a contentious exchange between us. Trump was clearly irritated by it, but after the debate, he seemed just fine. He told reporters that everyone did well, that he believed I had been fair. I did my show that night from inside the Fox Theater. Doug came over moments before and gave me a long hug. It said more than congratulations. It felt more like, you made it. It had been a long 8 months. Doug and I had been in the bunker together. He had weathered every Trump attack right by my side. In fact, the experience had been harder for Doug in many ways, as sometimes it is more painful for someone to watch a loved one get attacked than to be directly on the receiving end. Many times, Doug had wanted to respond to Trump, to call him up, to write an op-ed, to track him down and let him have it. But he knew that wouldn't help anything. We had to stay quiet and let the storm pass. Vincenza captured that hug on camera. When I look at it now, I remember the exact feelings I had in that moment. Love for my husband, and such gratitude that I have him. I felt like we had finally turned a corner, that this thing with Trump was finally over. I should have known that when it came to Trump, it was never over. On Tuesday, March 8th, Trump won the Michigan primary. The following Sunday, he started in again on me. He let loose on Fox News Sunday, complaining about our Trump University exchange. What happened in that week after the debate? To this day, I do not know. A week after Michigan, Trump won Florida, ending Marco Rubio's presidential campaign. In the wake of his victory, he celebrated by ramping up his attacks on me. As the Washington Examiner put it, GOP frontrunner Donald Trump took aim at Fox News' Megyn Kelly Tuesday evening with a flurry of insults over Twitter, just moments after he was declared the winner in Florida's Republican primary. He fired off a slew of tweets. Crazy at Megyn Kelly is unwatchable. Can't watch crazy Megyn anymore. Talks about me at 43%, but never mentions that there are four people in the race, with two people big and over. Many anchors were quoting the same poll numbers, but hearing it from me was always different for Trump. Or maybe I was just part of his game. Here we go again, I thought. Tom Lowell and I worried, at times, that the calls for a boycott would have an effect. Roger put my mind at ease. In 40 years, I've never seen a call for a boycott work, he said. And he was right. My numbers remained very strong throughout the year of Trump. But Trump's campaign against me did have serious ramifications. Every time Trump acted up, so did his supporters. Every time he tweeted about me, it was like he flipped a switch, instantly causing a flood of intense nastiness. The number of harassing tweets, Facebook messages, online comments, articles, and even negative face-to-face public interactions would increase exponentially. There would be more strategy meetings at work, more stressful calls from my boss at all hours. There would be heightened security issues when I left Fox News at night, and when I arrived home. One night, after a Trump attack, a suspicious man showed up in the lobby of my apartment building, close to midnight, demanding to see me. When questioned by the doorman, he turned and ran. How did he know where I live? Where my kids live? Paparazzi and other unfamiliar men started showing up, a first for us in New York, on the sidewalk outside of our building, taking pictures of me and Doug and our children. Part of this was laughable. We imagined the photographers watching our every errand with bated breath. There they go! To Petco! Extra, extra, what's in the bag? Pet fish! Stop the presses! Thankfully, we managed to keep the pictures of our kids from being published, or at least to have their faces blurred. We don't publicize or post online pictures of our kids due to security concerns and out of respect for their privacy. The voice messages, hate mail, and online attacks would also spike after each Trump tweet. I had perspective on them. I realized this wasn't fighting in Syria, but it wasn't a day at the beach, either. A sampling on a typical day, which I really have no desire to read, but I'm going to give you a flavor. You're a real C-word. F off, you blank. I will beat you up so bad, I will force you to support Trump, you blank. You B-word. A twisted B-word. This blank at Megyn Kelly will get hers sooner or later. Media blank. biased, unfair, and no professionalism. B-word. The B-word from Rupert Murdoch News, no thanks, hashtag expletive. You suck and you're a hack. You're not all that. You lose. Trump wins. You really need to stop bashing Trump. You must be a Democrat or a liberal. Don't watch your show anymore. Won't watch it again until they fire you. I could go on. What confused me was that by this point, Trump was winning the race for the nomination. He had vanquished everyone but Ted Cruz, who is at least as disliked by Republicans as Trump was, and way behind in the delegate count. The prospect of Trump as the nominee was getting more and more likely, and yet he maintained his focus on me. If winning couldn't distract him from coming after me, would anything? This will keep going until he chooses to stop or he loses, I thought. But he wasn't stopping, and he wasn't losing. That meant I likely had months, or even months plus 8 years, more of this. Over and over, I thought surely things had gotten as absurd as they would get, only to be proven wrong. One day, my mom told me a strange man had contacted her, trying to dig up dirt on me. Two friends of mine reached out saying much the same. Was it a tabloid? A private investigator? Was I in this race? Or a journalist covering it? The Trump army seemed not to care. 2 weeks later, on March 21st, Fox News was supposed to have a Republican debate in Salt Lake City. Trump decided not to come. "We've had enough debates," he said. It got canceled. Frankly, I was relieved. I didn't want to deal with the nonsense again. We flew to Florida for a Disney vacation, our family and our security guard. Yes, we took an armed guard to the Magic Kingdom. More guns, more guards. My year of Trump. "Why is Mike here in Disney?" our kids asked. We'd all seen a lot of Mike that year. What do you say to your children when they ask you that question? We didn't want to scare them, especially given Yardley's existing concern. "He's here to help us, honey," I said. I think my kids were a little confused about how he could be helping us by standing next to us online for It's a Small World, but luckily they didn't press the question. We did have a couple of nasty encounters, but nothing violent. Worrying about physical harm at Disney World was definitely new territory for me and Doug. We kept thinking we'd encountered the darkest moment, only to find a new one right behind it. From strangers at our house, to security at Disney, to our 4-year-old daughter asking what the word bimbo means. But the lowest point for me was something much quieter. The Fox PR folks and I had spent many late nights at the office, watching the tweets roll in, staying steady at the helm, refusing to respond. But when Trump started up again in March, out of nowhere, after his Florida win, Irina Briganti was not pleased. She told me she believed that he had crossed a line. She felt it had become abusive, and she issued a statement defending me and calling Trump's vitriolic attacks, his extreme, sick obsession with me, beneath the dignity of a presidential candidate who wants to occupy the highest office in the land. "Irina," I said to her, "this is just my new reality. I've come to accept it." As soon as the words left my mouth, I heard the resignation in them, the defeat. When I got home that night, I couldn't stop thinking about what I'd said. "This is just my new reality." That doesn't sound like me, I thought. I sound like a sad little martyr. Biding my time until things improved was one thing. Pathetically resigning myself to the never-ending antics of a bully was another. And that right there was the sound of me hitting bottom. Because that wasn't me. My commitment to myself is to settle for more. Yet here I was, ready to accept a life of stress and attempted bullying that could go on for years. A life that acquiesced to being what Maureen Dowd described in a column as Donald Trump's chew toy. In that passive, resigned stance, I didn't recognize myself. My low point didn't come from the threats or the hate. It wasn't the shots at my credibility or the lame insult of crazy. It was the moment when I no longer felt I was being true to who I was, to the person I had worked so hard to become ever since that late night in Chicago, watching Oprah. I knew where the feeling of resignation came from, of course. The previous 9 months had taken their toll. The security scares, the harassment, the threats, the guards, the pressure at work and on the air, it was all-consuming. I had long since stopped being able to find any kind of humor in this mess. Laughter wasn't a coping tool, because this wasn't funny. It was deeply unsettling, and appeared to be never-ending. And in that moment, I knew, once and for all, that I must put a stop to this. Roger had tried. Hannity had tried. Bill Shine had tried. Time had passed. Trump wasn't stopping. And I was done sitting back and taking it. Way back in seventh grade, I'd made a promise to myself not to tolerate bullies. Now I had to honor it. I would take control of my own life. I would get back to a normal state of affairs, one where I was reporting the story, not part of it. You can't respond to irrational behavior rationally, my mother always says. Trump has an irrational love of controversy, of acrimony. He clearly liked the idea of our fight, of the drama. He enjoyed it as a storyline, and if it were up to him, I believe he would have kept it going and going, which meant it would be up to me to write the two of us an ending. Then I saw an answer staring me in the face. I knew he wouldn't come on the Kelly file, but I was preparing for my Fox broadcasting special, which was, by its nature, a more casual, less aggressive venue. Trump would be a natural lead interview. He had already done Barbara Walters' 10 Most Fascinating People series 3 times. A record, he once told me. Talking to him face-to-face could reestablish a sane relationship. If my year of death threats was a highway, that sit-down looked distinctly like an off-ramp. The question was, would he do it? I thought he might. He was inches away from securing the nomination, but he was looking at a possible contested convention and a bare-knuckle general election. And he hadn't spoken one word to the 9 o'clock p.m. host on Fox News in 9 months, which he had to see as a liability. My ratings were stronger than ever. His calls for a boycott hadn't made a dent. Millions of women and independents, two groups Trump needed badly, watched the Kelly file. So there were good reasons on both sides for the meeting. I reached out to him through 2 different people and asked for a meeting. First he said no, and then he said yes. Chapter 23, The Trump Tower Accords. The morning of the meeting, I woke up around 7 a.m., poured myself a cup of coffee, and got Yates and Yards off to school. Normally at home, I am happy, and certainly when I am around Thatcher. But that day, I was anxious. I did not know what to expect. I believed, sitting face to face, Trump would be cordial. My goal was simple, to put a stop to his behavior and remove myself as a storyline from the 2016 election. If I could also secure an interview, great. Chris and Vincenza came over to help me get on my hair and makeup. Typically, when they get me ready at my house, it's a lighthearted hour. We play music, drink coffee, tell stories, and laugh with the kids. That day, we didn't speak much at all. They knew I was preoccupied. "Do you want me to keep it natural?" Vincenza asked, "since it's daytime?" "No," I said. "I need my game face on." I went in my bedroom and put on my black Gucci sheath dress with a belt, a pair of black pumps, and I was ready to go. Thatcher was feeling sad about my leaving that day, saying, "Mommy, don't go. Mommy, stay here." While those moments usually kill me, I was in an entirely different place that morning. "Thatch," I said, "Mom's gotta go. I'll see you later. I love you." I kissed him on the head, took a deep breath, and walked out, with the gals waving and blowing kisses at me as they packed up their gear. Doug insisted on coming along in the car, and I did not object. We planned on getting lunch together after, and I knew I would be glad to have him there to debrief when it was over. Many people offered to go into the meeting with me. Doug, Fox anchor Brian Kilmeade, who had successfully brokered the meeting, and Bill Getty, who was producing the Fox broadcast special. But it was clear to me I needed to do this by myself. Just me and Trump. No one to distract us, no one to screw it up. I think they all wanted to protect me somehow, but I needed no protection. The texts from the few people who knew what was about to happen came in. "This is like waiting for the kickoff in the Super Bowl," wrote one friend. I have heart palpitations right now, texted Janice Dean, sending all my love and energy to you. We got there right at 11 a.m. As I got out of the car, Doug said, Babe, when you get in there, just pretend it's your desk and your studio. He knows how the anchor desk makes me feel. I'll be fine, I said, and closed the door. The newspapers the next day would say that I entered the building incognito. Not true. I was wearing my black dress, with a black coat on top of it, with no hat, wig, or sunglasses, as fun as that would have been. I entered on the residence side of the building. The doorman opened the door for me. His eyes grew to the size of silver dollars when he recognized me, now just 20 stories away from Trump. Hello, he said warmly. Wow, good to see you. Trump's security guard, Keith, a former NYPD detective, was waiting in the lobby for me. He gave me a nice greeting and said, right this way. We walked together to the elevator, got in, and Keith directed the elevator operator where to go. When I walked into his office, Trump was sitting behind his desk, smiling. He got up immediately and came around to greet me. I moved in for a handshake, but he held out his arms for a hug. And the next thing I knew, we were hugging hello. We are hugging, I thought. Donald Trump is hugging me, and I am hugging him. There was a part of me that felt like I was betraying myself by hugging this man who had insulted me so publicly and had created such security and privacy concerns for me and my family over the past 9 months. But it felt like a kind gesture on his part, an effort to say, if not, I'm sorry, perhaps let's move on, which was what I was there for. Hi, I said. Hi, how are you? He responded. I'm good, how are you? I'm good too, he said. Proud of you in a certain way. Please sit down. This was going well so far. Wait, proud of me? I sat down in the chair across from Trump's desk. His office is large and spectacular. Huge windows wrap around two of the four walls, overlooking Central Park and Fifth Avenue, and the high-end shops down below. The walls were lined with memorabilia and photos of himself with other celebrities. On his desk were stacks of magazines with him on the cover, People, Time, and about a dozen others, with several copies of each one per stack. I told him that I had felt a little nervous coming over. Why did I say that?